from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the wee hours of March 30th, 1867, as recounted by professor and author Lee Farrow. The United States signed a treaty to purchase Russia's North American possessions, adding more than 580,000 square miles. And in the days to come, some American citizens and journalists would express surprise and some frustration that the whole thing with Russia seemed to happen overnight in the dark. And one of the men behind it, Secretary of State William Seward, had never been to this territory that we know as Alaska. What exactly were we purchasing from Russia, and why? One newspaper editorial referred to it as a polar bear garden and a waste of taxpayer money. But Professor Farrow points out we've sort of propagated a myth here. We know the purchase even today as Seward's folly, but for the most part, the reviews were pretty positive. They certainly weren't universally panned or negative at the time, and her new book is a kind of scholarly effort that sets the record straight and the whole affair. And what timing! The Seward House Museum in Auburn is celebrating 150 years since the purchase with a series of educational efforts and events, and there are some echoes that we can feel today as we evaluate how politics works. After all, Professor Farrow, who wrote the book, is a distinguished teaching professor in the Department of History and a director of the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching at Auburn University at Montgomery in Alabama, and her previous work on the history of Russian-American relations. What a fascinating time to be alive today, and what would Seward say now? Well, Lee Farrow is on the line with us, the author of Seward's Folly, A New Look at the Alaska Purchase. Professor Farrow, thanks for taking the time to join the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeff Ludwig is in studio with me. He's the director of education at the Seward House Museum in Auburn. Thanks for making the trip in. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, we're going to have a lot of fun this hour. And Professor Farrow, I couldn't help but note, I mean, I know most of your work looks to me at least like it's from the 19th century, but whew, what a time for American-Russian relations right now, huh?
It is, and I taught a class on the history of Russian-American relations this spring to coordinate with the anniversary of the Alaska Purchase, but I had no idea that there'd be so much else going on when I planned this course, so it was a great course.
Well, as we all know, William Seward thought that the whole description of Alaska as a polar bear garden, he called it fake news, right? I mean, I think that's what Seward used to,
yeah,
he used to go around saying hashtag fake news. It's a fascinating time here. But Lee is going to be here. And Jeff, why don't you set the table a little bit for us, because with the sesquicentennial finally here, you've already done a few things that are really interesting, and I'd love to hear some stories. And why don't you set the table before we kind of dive into Lee's book and these stories and kind of correcting some of the record here. Why don't you tell us what's been going on and what's coming up as well?
Sure. This whole year for us is about Seward's Folly, commemorating the sesquicentennial. We have sent out on loan the Emanuel Leutze signing of the Treaty of Session. Emanuel Leutze, an artist perhaps most famous for Washington crossing the Delaware. Beautiful, maybe his second most famous painting, is usually on display in the Seward House. It's been in our dining room. Right now, it's making the rounds in Alaska. We have a special exhibit. It's all about Seward's Alaska Purchase, the rise of the so-called folly reputation, and chronicling Seward's 1869 trip. Essentially, after leaving office at the end of the Johnson administration, Seward visits Alaska to see what $7.2 million bought the country. And we've got some of the pieces that he brought home from that. We're really excited. We had the unveiling of a brand new statue of William Seward, years in the making, just last Saturday. The statue is on its way west following a very similar journey that Seward took along the rails to the west coast and then a steamer up to Alaska, where it will be installed on the State House grounds in Juneau. And of course, next month, June 25th at 7, we're really delighted to bring Professor Farrow to Auburn. She's going to give a talk for us on her book, a book signing. That's going to be 7 p.m. June 25th at Theater Mac in Auburn.
All right, so you've got a lot going on. And by the way, later this hour, I am going to ask Jeff and maybe Lee as well, not to, you know, poor William Henry Seward. This is not fair to him, but I do want the story of the shame poll. I want to know some of these juicy bits of what happened and when Seward did go to Alaska. But before we even get there, let's back it up. And Jeff, let me start with you. You said even today you have visitors in Auburn. You've got people who live in Auburn. I was asking Jeff before the hour began, if we walked down State Street and we talked to 100 people, how many would know that Abraham Lincoln was not going to be president? Seward was going to be president. How many people would know that, at least that much about Seward? And you said, well, what if we did that in Auburn? You know, and that kind of surprised me.
It's true. Auburn is rightly quite proud of its history. Our nickname is History's Hometown. The Harriet Tubman House is a mile from the Seward House. Their stories are intrinsically linked. But yet, almost every day, a visitor will come into the Stewart House to take a tour and sort of rather bashfully say that I've lived here all my life. I've never been inside before. And I think people in Rochester sometimes do that too, taking our great history for granted.
Sure.
Until you finally open yourself up to it. So would you like me to give some of the Seward stories?
Yeah, why don't you just do the quick snapshot?
Sure, the quick snapshot is the Seward House Museum is a 201-year-old historic house museum. 99.9% of the things inside are original. It really is a living time capsule into the 19th century. It's only ever been the private home to four generations of the same family or this museum. It passed directly from Seward hands to museum hands, and therefore it really is a rarity to be able to see a collection like this. It makes telling Seward stories come to life. And William Seward arrives in Auburn in 1823, a 22-year-old man. He moves into the house in 1824, marrying the judge's daughter. Judge Elijah Miller had built the house in 1816 to raise his two daughters. Seward marries the younger. He moves into the house, begins to raise a family, and within a few years, he's rising in politics. He decides to leave the law behind and will run for office, taking a state Senate seat in 1830, serve for two terms, and then two terms as New York governor, two terms as U.S. Senator from New York. And then, as you've mentioned, Evan, in 1860, the whole country thinks it's going to be Seward, the 16th president of the United States. I'd love to get into that story if we have time, but he's a little overconfident. The tale of how he ends up losing the nomination to an upstart, a true dark horse candidate, is fascinating. We tell it to every visitor who comes to the house. And then, to his great surprise, Abraham Lincoln, this little lawyer, as Seward once called him, taps him, this former rival, to join, as Doris Kearns Goodwin has famously labeled, the team of rivals as Secretary of State. He'll serve under President Lincoln during the Civil War years, under Andrew Johnson during Reconstruction, and then, of course, it's under Johnson in 67 that he makes the folly still bearing his name, Seward's Folly, Alaska Purchase, March 30th, 1867.
And he is often referred to as one of the one, two, or three most powerful and influential secretaries of state this country's had. Certainly influential when it came to issues like slavery, which we will talk about later this hour. He was, I would say, involved. He was a victim in the three-headed assassination plot. I mean, everybody knows John Wilkes Booth and the assassination of President Lincoln, but Seward was also attacked and nearly killed that night in a fascinating story there. So just, you know, the history that is right in front of us and right there at the Seward House Museum, which is open when? When can people go there and see it?
We're open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5. It's an hourly tour in the summer starting first Sunday in June. We're also open Sundays 1 to 5.
Okay. Professor Farrow, have you been here?
I have not, so this will be my first time.
Well, I think they're going to be excited to have you. And again, that's June 25th for Professor Farrow. If you want to mark your calendar, Lee's going to be talking about. The book is beautiful, by the way. It's called Seward's Folly, A New Look at the Alaska Purchase by Professor Farrow, who's on the line with us. And you decided to write this now. Why, Lee?
Well, I mean, it's a, sort of an interesting story. I'll just go back a bit. When I was in graduate school, I had actually taken classes with Stephen Ambrose, you know, of World War II fame. One of the things he told us is look for anniversaries. People love to read about events during anniversaries. And so I sort of had that tucked away in my mind. And I went on a cruise to Alaska. And I went into the bookstore in Sitka and thought, you know, I really don't know that much about the Alaska Purchase. I'm a Russian historian, but I'm a little rusty on this. And thought I'd pick something up to read and discovered there was nothing there. And so when I got home, I did a little bit of research. I discovered that the last adult book on the Alaska Purchase had been written in 1975. And so I contacted University of Alaska Press and said, you know, there needs to be a book for the sesquicentennial, and I'd like to write it. What do you think? And they thought it was a great idea. And so that's how this book came about.
Should we stop calling it Seward's Folly? I mean, we still do, but you've pointed out in talks that I've seen you give that, you know, it's sort of a myth that we've propagated that it was widely and immediately panned, even though there were some editorials that called it, what, like a polar bear garden or Seward's Folly, Seward's Icebox. Those terms did come out, but that wasn't every single response, right?
Right. And, I mean, we really shouldn't call it Seward's Folly. And I have to say, you know, we chose the name of the book, and there were, I actually have gotten a little bit of blowback from a couple of people about that, but I knew that was the name everyone recognized,
yeah.
And so the editor and I decided it was a good name for the book because we wanted people to know what it was about the minute they looked at the cover. But indeed, at the time, there were some detractors, but and you know, and some legitimate concerns about purchasing a piece of territory that few people knew much about. But overall, there was much less controversy and much less opposition than sort of popular history has passed on to us.
So before we get to the deal done in the dark, so to speak, and some of the history of that interesting night alone, you know, with Seward saying, you know, the lights will be on at midnight and meet me there and we'll get a deal done, and how that happened. Before we go there, you know, Lee, you've said that really kind of the seeds were planted as far back as the Crimean War. Is that right?
Right, right. So, you know, early on, even in the early 1850s, there were some in Russia who recognized that Alaska was probably not something they could hold on to for very long. Russia was fighting the Crimean War at the time, and there were concerns about Great Britain perhaps seizing Russian America. And so there was actually a sort of a shady deal that was conceived where they would enact a fictitious sale to pretend that it was being sold to someone so that the British couldn't seize it. But before that ever went through, the British went ahead and excluded Russian America from the war. But nonetheless, this got people thinking in Russia about the possibility that this was just something that maybe they shouldn't hold on to anymore.
How did the British come into play here in terms of consideration for both the Americans and the Russians?
A shared animosity for Great Britain was certainly one of the factors that contributed to this deal and the concerns over Russian America. Both the United States and Russia had had bad dealings with Great Britain in recent years, and, of course, because of the proximity of British North America to Russian America, this was a constant concern, and so, you know, definitely influenced this. And people at the time recognized this as well. Many of the newspaper articles that came out, both the United States and in European newspapers, referred to this. They mentioned this possibility that it had something to do with, you know, fears of Great Britain or animosity toward Great Britain.
And Seward, at the time, from what you've been able to research, Professor Farrow, you know, he thought ultimately the best case scenario was that territory would be what for the United States?
Well, I mean, he assumed that we would absorb it eventually. And there are a number of quotes that I found where he publicly said, you know, this will eventually be ours. So he was an expansionist, and everyone knew this about him. He wanted to acquire this, but he had said this actually years before the Alaska Purchase.
What was the assumption of what that land was like? I mean, you say, I mean, he hadn't been there, and he wouldn't travel there until a couple of years after the purchase, but what did they really know about it?
Well, there had been some explorers, so there were some reports which were available to Seward and other people. Not a lot, but we had some information at that point. And, of course, there was a recognition that this could be a potential launching off point for greater trade with Asia, which was something that was of growing interest on the West Coast especially.
And so, Jeff, was it Seward's son who kind of wrote the description that you sent me of what happened, you know, kind of characterizing some of the events leading up to the actual the deal getting done there? Was that his son that I was reading?
Yes, I sent you a speech from Frederick Seward.
Frederick,
Mr. and Mrs. Seward had five children, mm-hmm. three sons, and the middle son, Frederick, was his father's assistant secretary of state during Seward's two terms, and traveled with him to Alaska in 1869, would make later trips as well, and was sort of recounting the legacy, including something that we tell visitors quite frequently, especially this year, that towards the end of his life, Seward sat with Francis Carpenter from Homer, New York, famously the artist behind Lincoln's first draft reading of the Emancipation Proclamation, the cover of Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, and today available at the Capitol. And Carpenter asked Seward in his waning years what he thought he would most be remembered for. And there was quite a lot Seward could have said. And he said, Alaska, even though there were detractors, though he acknowledged that it might be a generation before the country realized it. So he and Frederick were both on that same page and aware that Alaska was likely to have long-term benefits.
Did Seward prove to be wrong about anything? I mean, history has proven he was pretty wise. You know, and later this hour, we're going to talk more about, when I say wrong about anything, Seward and his wife were not at odds over whether slavery should exist, but what should be done and how immediately, which is a very interesting story of its own right, which, again, before we get to that, let's pull it back to this deal that I want to talk about. So Jeff was talking about Frederick's writing and describing the deal. Jeff, we do have a lot of great records and letters and material that helps us understand Seward, the people around him, his mindset, don't we? It's a pretty good set of material.
We certainly do. I went to graduate school at the University of Rochester, where, as you know, Evan, you had some guests on not long ago as part of the Digital Humanities Project.
I love what they're doing.
Digitizing the Seward letters. We work closely with them. Every couple of weeks, I log in to see what's new there. So we've got thousands of pieces of correspondence, a great paper trail to follow. Seward was a prodigious letter writer. He and his wife spent much of his almost 40-year career apart. So their marriage was sustained through the mails. Likewise, with many of his relationships with his children, there are these intimate pieces of correspondence. He was working on an autobiography when he passed away at the age of 71. His son Frederick, who was by his father's side for much of his career, would finish it. So we've got autobiographical writings. Seward himself was an author. He wrote a biography of John Quincy Adams. When he wasn't traveling or on the road for politics, he seemed to always be nose in a book or writing, working on his own writings.
I really enjoyed Walter Starr's book, Seward. He was on the program in 2014. And, you know, Doris Kearns Goodwin, David McCullough get a lot of love, and deservedly so. Starr did a really nice job on Seward, a book that even 500-plus pages, to me, read pretty quickly. And one of the great joys was going back through the letters and in the inclusion of a lot of that material. Lee, how much material did you find to work with for your own work?
There is a lot of material available here, both in published and archival sources. So I was able to obtain a lot of things through my university library's interlibrary loan. I did travel to D.C. and look at archives, the National Archives microfilm records, particularly the correspondence between our State Department and our representatives in other countries in Europe at the time to see what the reaction was internationally to the purchase.
All right, so let's find out why it's still known as the deal done in the dark, or why it was known that way at the time. Professor Farrow, how did the deal get done?
Well, there had been this discussion that had been going on a bit about the possibility of the United States buying Russian America from Russia, but it had been sort of very tentative and sort of hot and cold over many years, as you've already mentioned, based on various circumstances. So, for example, when the Civil War came around, of course, everything was put on the back burner. But in late 1866, it seemed that finally things were moving forward. And Stokoe, who was the Russian minister here in the United States, went home for a visit, and he got sort of a final confirmation that yes, he should go back to the United States and initiate this this process of selling Russian America to the United States. And he returned in early 1867, and then things just sort of transpired over a matter of weeks until finally Stokoe was able to communicate to Seward that, you know, he was ready to go. And as you mentioned earlier, Stokoe actually said, well, we can do this tomorrow. And Seward said, no, come on over right now. I'll summon my people. And so both men summoned their secretaries, and they all assembled at Seward's house. And the document was signed at about 4 a.m. So it really did transpire very quickly at the end, but there was a long history behind it overall.
And Professor Farrow, given the fact that it transpired that way in the overnight hours, you know, from midnight to 4, getting that deal done, did that, you know, today we would use the term optics. Did the optics impact the public? Was that a problem at all?
Absolutely. Many people were concerned about that, particularly in Congress. There were people in the Senate who were very upset about this, and in the House of Representatives also, because it seemed that the whole thing had transpired so quickly and overnight, and they wondered, why did it have to be so secretive? If it's such a good deal, why did it have to be a secret? So that did contribute some to the opposition that that the treaty experienced on Capitol Hill, especially in the House of Representatives when it came time to voting on an appropriation bill.
And so what is the answer? Why couldn't Seward have waited?
You know, I think he could have, but the session of Congress was coming to an end that very next day, as a matter of fact, and he wanted to seal the deal, sort of strike while the iron was hot, and he knew that this was an opportunity to do that, and so he moved on as quickly as he could have. And it may have been a strategic move as well, because what ended up happening, of course, is we assumed ownership, physical ownership at least, of the territory before the next session of Congress opened, which meant that by the time it was time to vote on the appropriation bill, we had already physically taken possession of the territory, which made it more difficult for people to vote against appropriation.
What do you think? Jeff? How do you answer the question when people ask, you know, well, why a deal done in the dark? Why did Seward do it that way?
I answer very similarly. He was at home having just finished dinner and playing a game of whist when the knock came. I was going to mention
what's whist, by the way,
a card game that Seward loved. And
does anybody still play whist, by the way? You should play it at the house there.
I'm thinking maybe a whist tournament for a fundraiser.
I totally agree.
But a great little Rochester connection, and Professor Farrow alludes to this in her book, that when de Stokel returns before coming to try to get the ball rolling with Seward, he had a very shadowy meeting with a gentleman who most likely was Thurlow Weed. Weed got his start as the person running the Rochester Telegraph newspaper in the 1820s, and he and Seward meet in their early 20s just outside of Rochester. They become lifelong friends. We have a beautiful portrait of Weed in the house. And he knew that this moment was coming. I think Weed tipped him off that this was likely to fall into his lap. He was certainly, as Professor Ferris suggests, an agent in many regards of manifest destiny, looking for expansionist opportunities, seized the moment. One of the things we do to interpret it with the backdrop of this Leutze painting, in which you can see the gaslights burning bright behind as Seward and de Stokel are both pointing at Russian America, soon to be Alaska, on Seward's globe, is how Seward convinced the U.S. Senate to come along with him between March 30th and April 9th, when the Senate ratified the treaty, 37-2, which is pretty amazing. Piece of almost, I guess you would say, today, bipartisan support. And he used what we interpret as dining room diplomacy. We have his dining room table set as visitors would have seen it when they came to dine with Seward. He was famous for hosting dinner parties of a dozen or more courses. And over one of these rambling, politically purposeful nights, he would win over support. This was his magic wand. And during these almost 2 weeks, he hosted a series of Alaskan-themed dinners. Lee's got a nice line in her book about how he was serving Russian-American cod and other Alaskan-themed items from off his menu. And soon enough, he knew he'd be able to call it American cod, Russian-American furs brought in. And we talk about dining room diplomacy being a pivotal way that Seward convinced the powers that be. He also had a great PR sense of mind. He had the Smithsonian and Civil War heroes sort of worked together to be working the public and promoting this as a good idea. So Seward was pretty shrewd about optics. To get back to your question, he had some pretty good ideas for how to get the public and the political powers to rally around him here.
This is this is gonna be a strange comparison, but for me, one of the modern figures I think of in the Seward mold is Barack Obama. Andrew Sullivan wrote for years, the political writer Sullivan, who became a big Barack Obama supporter. One of his favorite terms for Obama was meep meep, using the roadrunner. You think that that you're beating, and all of a sudden he blows by you. And he said Obama knew that you don't win the race on the first day. You know, when it came to same-sex marriage, Sullivan suspected all along that Obama wanted to see it done, but he knew that you couldn't push it right away all in the same day. And then all of a sudden, you figure out how to win the long game, and you set up the dominoes. And Seward seemed to be that way. He was that long-term strategizer. He knew how to use dining room diplomacy. He knew how to figure out who was involved and how are we going to get their support. He moved a lot of pieces around. And so 37 to 2, you said?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. So, yeah, go ahead.
And if I may say, the same approach to slavery. There were many, his wife included, who wished he'd been more radical. He had a reputation for being a radical anti-slavery man. We're very careful to distinguish him from the abolitionist movement because he's not quite there, but he's a strong anti-slavery man, and he plays the long game, starting from the time he wins the governor's mansion, 1838, opposing slavery as New York governor, refusing to extradite runaway slaves, going to the U.S. Senate, giving his famous higher law speech, in which he declares there is a higher law than the Constitution, which legally recognized slavery as part of the fabric of America. So he played a long game over the first 33 years of his political career, leading him to that famous Carpenter captured moment, the first draft reading of the Emancipation Proclamation. And even there, people are often surprised when we tell them that in the summer of 1862, when Lincoln assembled his team of rivals, his cabinet, including Seward, his by then right hand, and announced that he was considering transforming the war from one about states' rights and secession to the moral cause of slavery, Seward urged him to slow down and to not rush because the war was going so badly. He worried it would look desperate and weak, and he urged Lincoln to wait until the North could win a battle first. So even as Lincoln is this close to signing a piece of paper, the Emancipation Proclamation, Seward is thinking long term, what is the best strategy for effectively getting this done?
Let me read a section from Lee's book here. Lee, this is what you write on exactly this subject about Seward. You know, you talked about in one passage in your book about how he was a supporter of emancipation. He had harbored fugitives in his home, had given financial support to Frederick Douglass' abolitionist newspaper, the North Star. But like Lincoln, quote, Seward recognized that he might sometimes be forced to set aside his own beliefs about human rights in the face of political necessity, end quote. So a pragmatist when necessary, kind of a chess player. Yes, Lee?
Yes, absolutely. He was a shrewd politician. He recognized that sometimes you have to compromise.
But Jeff was saying before the hour began, and I think this is important to point out here, you know, Seward, there are plenty of analogs today. I mean, I brought up Obama, and there are a lot of people who would say that, well, Obama shouldn't have ever said, if he was really for same-sex marriage, he should never have said that marriage was one man, one woman, if he didn't believe it in his heart, even if he was being pragmatic, even if he won in the long run. Sometimes we have to be direct about what we view as civil rights, human rights, and some are more urgent. Seward's wife really was more urgent, and you said there was a moment where she kind of warned him, you're being so pragmatic that you risk becoming what?
She worried he was going to fall in line in this moderate tradition of compromisers, the next Webster or Clay, people who were making these grand compromises, preventing war, staying that moment of crisis, but at what cost? Kicking the can down to the point where this, as Seward called it, irrepressible conflict was coming. She worried that he was going to be the next person who deferred from dealing with this, as she said, the cost of hundreds of thousands of people whose lives would be lost to slavery. Seward's politics towards slavery were long term. He really was looking to contain slavery where it was and to pin it in and allow it to die, and pushing that death, but not at the cost of instant abolition, which would have resulted in bloodshed. He was playing that long game. His politics are really interesting because there are those in his career who call him a firebrand radical. John Brown thought he saw something there in Seward and sent him a picture. Many thought Seward knew what Brown was going to do before Harper's Ferry. And yet in the 1860s, when he's serving under Andrew Johnson, there are many who consider him a sellout to the party, that he's too conservative for radical Republicans. So unpacking his legacy is really quite complicated. There are Southerners before the war who call him the most dangerous man in America since Aaron Burr. And then there's his wife who thinks he's not nearly dangerous enough. And she's got a really interesting legacy of her own as really a force behind her husband. And it's she who takes charge of establishing the House as a stop on the Underground Railroad. Harriet Tubman's house today sits on former Seward land. He became her landlord in 1859. In large part, she came to Auburn because of people like Seward, Martha Coffin Wright, but also Frances Seward, who was putting most of her energies into the anti-slavery cause.
And here's Frances Seward. Here's a name that you should hear more about to begin with, generally speaking, but also with suffrage celebrations coming up, a lot of focus going to be happening. You've heard about the Votilla, which is going to be happening, I think, in July?
Mm-hmm. It's July.
In July. But Frances Seward didn't really want the limelight. I mean, Jeff, you were saying she didn't show up on Seward's arm in sort of these events, right?
She did not. She didn't go to Albany with him after the first term in the state Senate. She would give him about a month out of every year when he was in Albany or Washington. She had work to do at home. She had a circle of intimates, Martha Coffin Wright, eventually Elizabeth Cady Stanton. We have Susan B. Anthony connections to the House. She thought that she was doing superficial work when she was on her husband's arm. He needed a hostess. His daughter-in-law did that. She enabled and was the perfect companion for the dining room diplomacy that Seward found a very effective tool. But Frances stayed home, not to demur political responsibility. She was a very well-educated woman. She went to the Troy Female Seminary, now the Emma Willard School, and poured herself into anti-slavery and also women's rights. She is a force behind the Married Women's Property Rights Act of 1848. And we'll find that she can get more done when she's operating from this great burned over community of Western and Central New York.
And did. I mean, you read some of the letters. She's like the conscience of that kind of keeping his mind on emancipation or abolition at some point, even if they disagreed on methods. I found that fascinating.
The, Oh, yes, the letters really do reveal a very, very interesting marriage of almost intellectual parity. With them so often apart, they wrote to each other sometimes several times a day. And there are letters of news from home, how the children are doing, gossip from Auburn or Albany. But there's a lot of politics. She's an advisor. She feels carte blanche to critique speeches of his that she reads in newspapers and often will let him have it in a way that nobody else can or will.
Great stuff. Well, we're going to get our only break of the hour. We'll come back. We'll grab a phone call. Dan and Brighton, hang there. We'll get you next. And then I want to ask Jeff Ludwig and Lee Farrow, our guests, about Seward's journey to Alaska, what he found there and what happened there. And that will also link in, I think, to some of what the Seward House Museum is doing this year, what they've already been doing, what they're up to now to celebrate the sesquicentennial of the ostensible Seward's Folly. Though that's just fake news, as we know. It's the story of the Alaska Purchase. And Lee Farrow is on the line with us. She is the author of Seward's Folly, A New Look at the Alaska Purchase. It's a beautiful book. She's going to be at the Seward House Museum in Auburn on June 25th for a 7 p.m. event. And books will be there, certainly by then, right?
And
right, Jeff?
We'll be selling them in our bookshop, too.
Oh, very good. So let's get that break and come back to your phone calls and more with our guests next. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Dan in Brighton. Oh, we don't have Dan, but we do have Ron in Brighton. Go ahead, Ron.
Yes, I'm surprised that you haven't mentioned Hiram Sibley, the president of Western Union, who lived at 400 East Avenue in Rochester. Prior to the Seward involvement, trying to work a line through what was then called the Russian extension, now Alaska, across the Bering Strait into Russia and then Western Europe as a precedent for Seward's interest in Alaska. And he met with the Romanov family prior to that, and I haven't heard you mention him.
Well, here's Ron, thank you for the phone call. Marjorie sent an email on a very similar subject, and I'll read this email here. She says, did Hiram Sibley's desire to expand Western Union through Alaska and across the Bering Straits have any influence on the decision to acquire Alaska? Some in Rochester point to the possibility that Sibley brought the riches of Alaska to Seward's attention. Sibley was in Russia in 1864 to 65 to negotiate with the Russians about obtaining permission to lay telegraph cable across this territory, so would have been very aware of the advantages to be gained. So that's from Marjorie. You heard Ron's phone call. Professor Farrow, anything to add to that?
Well, it's certainly possible that that Sibley's reports encourage further interest in Alaska. But as we've already discussed, the interest in obtaining Russian America went back much further, all the way to the Crimean War in the early 1850s. So I think there was already a pretty well-established interest in obtaining Russian America, and Seward certainly had mentioned it earlier than the 1860s.
Okay, and we've got Dan and Brighton next up. Go ahead, Dan. Hi, Dan.
I have several acquaintances named Seward, also obviously from upstate New York. They deny any connection with the secretary. I wonder if what are the chances that they're distantly related?
Dan, you think they're denying? I mean, there's nothing shameful. I know people named Lincoln,
But I don't know. They deny it.
Okay. Well, Dan, thank you. How many Sewards are around here, Jeff?
Thanks for your call, Dan. The last Seward to live in the Seward House was Mr. Seward's grandson, William Henry Seward III. Seward had five children. Only one of those five, his fourth-born and youngest son, William Seward Jr., would have a family of his own, a Civil War hero. He raised his family in his father's house, soon to be his house. He inherited the home in 1872. His only son, William Henry Seward III, had a son, William Henry Seward IV, who did not have a family. At least I don't believe he did. There are no more Sewards by that name with a direct connection to Seward, but Seward had brothers. He would adopt a nephew of his, and his granddaughters still have descendants.
Okay. So, Dan, maybe there's some tentacles that reach back more than they realize. But also interesting how few direct descendants there are, Jeff. Yeah.
Yeah, you might think that with the Sewards having five children, they would expect a lot of grandchildren. They actually convert their bedroom into a nursery when Francis's father, Seward's father-in-law, Elijah Miller, passes away in 1851, and just the three. So they did not have as many grandchildren as one might expect from a family as large as theirs.
Okay, I want to talk about, before I get back to your phone calls, about that journey to Alaska. So Lee, William Seward doesn't go to Alaska until after he is retired, right? The next president's in office, is that correct?
That's right.
And tell us about, I'll start with you, Lee, and I'll ask both of our guests to kind of take us through that journey.
Well, as Jeff mentioned, we have this account from his son who recorded what happened, and it was an interesting trip. It highlights a number of things, particularly I think sort of the difference between sort of standard American political culture at the time, and then the understanding of the native people who lived there, who in some cases were utterly confused by the idea that Russian America had been sold to the United States, and they viewed Seward as being, they thought maybe he had bought it, that he was actually the new owner of this territory. There's some very interesting stories about the interactions between Seward and his entourage and the Native Americans there. And it's interesting in present day, you know, because of course we know that there are many Native Alaskans who fought for recognition that much of this territory was theirs, and eventually won that recognition late into the 20th century. So it is a very interesting story.
Hmm. Jeff, why don't you take us through some of the details as you like to tell visitors of the Seward House Museum?
The whole process, even departing from Auburn, is interesting. In the spring of 1869, when Seward comes home, a widower, his wife Frances, will die 6 weeks after Abraham Lincoln. She is an eyewitness to the assassination attempt that nearly took Seward's life. He is stabbed by Lewis Powell, an accomplice of John Wilkes Booth and part of that cabal ring. And Seward himself is suffering from great pains, arthritis. He can barely hold a pen. His face is scarred. And interestingly enough, the new statue going on display in Juneau shows those scars. His friends and his neighbors told him to come home, take a much-deserved rest after 40 years of serving the public with a couple of breaks. And he basically declared that nonsense, rest is rust. He got on a train. He went across the country, stopping in some interesting places, Salt Lake City, for example, where he sat with Brigham Young, who told him that as a young journeyman mason, he did one of the mantelpieces in the Seward House when he was a 15-year-old living in Auburn. Getting to the coast, he took a steamship called the Active up into Alaska, where he arrives in Sitka, a city of about 1,000 souls. He's given the grand tour, will give a speech in the Lutheran Church, attend services, go to the mayor's house. And he will meet with Native Alaskans. Lee does a wonderful job in her book describing this. But one of our panels, one of the incidents that we described this year is a potlatch thrown for him by the Tlingit Native Alaskan peoples, in which he's honored with dinners and gifts, some of these gifts which you can come and see in the Seward House this year, and doesn't really reciprocate in a way that's expected. Seward is a traveler. He goes around the world several times. Many of the pieces in our house are items that he brought back, pieces of antiquity as European and African and Middle Eastern nations, Asian nations, opened up their treasure chest to him. So he was used to receiving, not giving. And today there is a shame totem pole of William Seward, the nose and ears painted red to indicate that he should be embarrassed. He's blushing from the shame that he brought to himself. And on one of our panels, our director of collections and exhibitions, Matt McVitie, who does a great job for us, writes that there's still an outstanding debt on the official Tlingit books. And today, 148 years after the incident, it's about $1.8 million.
There's a shame pole? It's an actual shame pole?
There's an actual shame pole.
Oh, boy. Wait, but the debt comes from what he should have given them as a gift?
Yes.
And they figured out the value?
Yes.
And does the Seward House Museum intend on paying this?
Well, it's complicated.
Is that a little bit more that's in your account?
And we aren't the descendants either. So to get back to that college question.
Oh, you are dodging now,
Jeff. We
such a dodge.
We interpret the legacy of the Seward House, Seward family.
I find this really interesting because this is not a guy who wasn't cultured. I mean, he was an experienced traveler. So just must have been a real misunderstanding there, Jeff.
Lost in translation, misapprehension. Or perhaps it was, again, sort of Seward was accustomed to a certain way of traveling and a certain deference, and he received almost like tribute. He was received, and it was a coup for Sitka to have invited him and for him to have come, to have lent his dignity and name to this outpost. And he was greeted the world over as this friend of Lincoln's, this liberator of men, this statesman of his generation. And his gift was his, I like to think anyway, in his mind, the time he took to travel, the speeches he would give, his company, and that wasn't nothing. It was a difficult, arduous journey to get there, and certainly the people in Sitka were delighted, and they hailed his arrival.
Okay. Well, Professor Farrow, what would you say is, I don't want to say a summation of Seward's trip to Alaska, though, but it's not just the shameful. I mean, it's a fun story to tell, but there's a lot more that came from it there. Do we learn whether he had any feelings of satisfaction, regret, surprise, anything like that?
Well, his son does record a speech that he gave before he left, in which he did express happiness, satisfaction with the purchase, and also had some positive words to say about the future and the growth eventually of Alaska and the interaction with the native people. So I think he was very pleased with his purchase when he visited there.
Okay. You agree with that, Jeff?
I do. I've read elsewhere that Seward very, very optimistically would proclaim after seeing it that Americans would soon enough be vacationing there, that the reports on its inhospitable climate were overblown, and he commented quite frequently on the weather. Other things, too, when he got there, the Russians who were invited to stay if they wanted to and become American citizens were keeping Russian time, and Americans coming in were keeping American time, no standardization of time.
Right.
That was really interesting to him, but he really thought he was an adventure tourist in many ways. He took a kayak trip upriver to see an eclipse. He was struck by the beauty of the place, and he thought that alone was worth plenty.
And if he could only, again, look to the future in the way that he would, noting that would be the thing in his legacy he's most remembered for, he's also right about the fact that people would want to travel there simply because travel got easier. Travel, it's much more comfortable. It's easy. You can be warm whenever you want to. I mean, we forget how arduous that was, just the process of travel itself, let alone temperature, discomfort, food, lodging, all of those things. But Professor Farrow, before we let you go, I do want to ask you, all the work that you've done writing the story, and I suspect your book, Seward's Folly, A New Look at the Alaska Purchase, which you will soon be able to get at the Seward House Museum if you don't get it online before that, I suspect this book is going to be sort of the standard on this story, a kind of a historical look at the story of what really happened. What would have happened in this country? What do you think the impact would have been had there been no Seward's Folly or Alaska Purchase?
It's hard to imagine. I mean, Alaska is such an important part of the United States now in so many ways, when it comes to energy, and it's at the center of many environmental debates. And it is this incredible vacation destination. I'll say from my own personal experience and from what others have told me that usually when people visit Alaska, they say it's one of the most beautiful places they've ever been to. So it's hard to imagine what we would be like as a country if we had not purchased this amazing piece of territory.
Seward himself, again, I'm going by what I think I recall from what Lee and Jeff are telling us, is he kind of viewed this as inevitable, that we're going to acquire this territory. But
right.
if we hadn't had the Alaska Purchase, do we assume it would have happened in a different way? The Russians had their own issues with the territory. Would they have held on to it? Is there any way to sort of guess what would have happened there, Professor Farrow?
I think it's likely that Great Britain would have acquired it.
Great Britain, okay.
Because Great Britain at the time was going through, what we now call Canada, British North America, was going through its own process of confederation at the exact same moment that Alaska was being purchased. And so I suspect that eventually Great Britain would have assumed ownership of that territory, either through war or purchase.
What do we most often get wrong about Seward's Folly, Professor Farrow?
I think it's the idea that the American public was against it. I every time I encounter people, they say this. And then I should add that on the Russian side, the most common thing that I hear when I talk to Russian audiences or meet Russian people is that somehow America did not pay for Alaska, or that the treaty was in some way illegitimate, or not a purchase at all. That maybe it was just a lease.
I think I heard yesterday, I told a friend that we're going to be talking about Seward's Folly, and they said, didn't we get Alaska for like a dollar? So that's another one of these myths. It wasn't a dollar. I think in today's dollars, it's like $123 million, something along those lines if you adjust for inflation. What was it, around seven and a quarter, something like that, Lee?
7.2.
$7.2 million, which was not nothing, but how did that price stack up at the time?
It was actually, I mean, it was a good price, and the Russians were happy with that price. It actually was more than Stokel had initially thought he could get for Russian America. So the notion that somehow the Russians were scammed in some way is absolutely ridiculous. The Russian government was happy with that purchase.
But did they get their money? Took them a while?
They did. They did get their money. It did take a little longer than it should have because of the delays on this side, but they did get their money, despite some rumors that they didn't.
Jeff, for you, what are the most common questions you get at the Seward House Museum, whether it's about the Folly or just Seward in general?
We get so many. People are definitely very curious about Tubman right now because we're looking at her on the 20. The site is becoming a national park, so we get a lot of questions. Seward and Tubman relationship, and it's a very strong one. He was her landlord. He worked to get her a military commission. The house passed from Seward hands to Tubman hands after her death. But Alaska, too, and we get the same sorts of questions. Did it cost $1, 2 cents an acre, which was what it cost? And that is usually what people come in remembering from high school social studies. They learned about Seward's Folly that one time, and they want to know more about it. Was it really a folly? And if you Google Seward's Folly, you do a Google image search, you're going to get all these political cartoons, and you would probably assume, and I at least done a wonderful job correcting this, that Seward was dogged by those exact words, and he wasn't. The word folly was not something thrown in his face again and again and again. That would become popularized later in the 1870s and really take root after his death. But these cartoons, illustrations, there's a great Thomas Nast one, caricaturist who loved Lincoln but turns on Seward. Old Mother Seward rubbing a Russian salve on Andrew Johnson's head, map of the Russian fairyland behind him. And these suggest that Seward had to immediately contend with this barrage of critiques. But as Lee points out, that simply wasn't true. Those would all come later and for some very complicated reasons.
If Seward were here today, I don't know that he would even take the time to use Twitter, but if he did, he would have perfect punctuation. There would never be misspelling. It would be almost poetry, I would think. I think he would be in many ways alarmed by the way we communicate now. That's one of the great pleasures of reading old letters, is the way we communicate has changed so much. And sometimes I get a little despondent that the depth of intellect of some leadership positions has changed. He was a fascinating person. Lee Farrow's book is a beautiful one. It's Seward's Folly, A New Look at the Alaska Purchase. She will be here June 25th, 7 p.m. Do you need to reserve space? What's the deal there, Jeff?
We're recommending that you call us or get your tickets online at sewardhouse.org. Our number is 315-252-1283, sorry.
You better do it again and more slowly.
Yep. 315-252-1283, or log in to sewardhouse.org. We'll have books for sale that night. I think we'll have room for walk-ins, but we're recommending that you call and make a reservation.
Well, it's a beautiful time of year. And Professor Farrow, I'll close with this. What are you most looking forward to on your trip here to the house?
I'm really looking forward to seeing the area. I've never been up to that area before. And of course, touring the house, which I've never been to either. So.
Well, we've learned so much from you and your work here, and I know they're looking forward to seeing you on June 25th, Professor Farrow. Thanks for taking the time for our program today.
Thank you.
And Jeff, you got about 20 seconds to tell us anything else related to the Folly or anything else you want people to know about that's going on this year, stuff that you've already been doing and what's going on.
Brand new this year, we've got a digital version of Mr. Seward's Diplomat's Gallery. As he traveled, he collected portraits, engravings, lithographs of a number of people. Often these are signed over to him. You can log on to our website. Again, that's sewardhouse.org. Go to our collections tab. You can find a picture of the Tsar of Russia, of Baron Edward de Stokel, with whom Seward brokered the deal, and so many more, and get a sense of his diplomacy.
Well, have fun this year out there. And, you know, they're open Tuesday through
Saturday, 10 to 5. And then the summer, we're also open Wednesdays, 1 to 5.
I'm not a paid staff member, but I will agree with Jeff. Sometimes what's right under our nose, it's amazing how often you talk to people and, you know, you've never been there, but you got a chance to change that. Jeff Ludwig's the Director of Education for the Seward House Museum. Great fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we said goodbye to Lee Farrow. You can see her June 25th and pick up her book, Seward's Folly, A New Look at the Alaska Purchase. Much more connections straight ahead.